My name is Reverend Dyson, for any of you who don't know me, and we thank you all who have come from near and far today. Have many of you had a chance to look at Bodhidharma's discourse on pure meditation? It's quite wonderful, and he comes from a very deep place, so I would say for myself, I wouldn't need to read it many times and study it much before getting to understand it either. But as you can see from the discourse, Bodhidharma's discourse on pure meditation, it's a series of questions from his disciple, Taiso Eka. And this is the same, it's either Kazon or Dogen, has a number of chapters where they have, that's actually Dogen, where they have questions from one of their disciples to them. And both Great Master Dogen and Great Master Bodhidharma have a great ability to kind of cut through the question and give, I think, a very direct answer, and as I said, coming from a very deep place, which I think it takes much study. But disciples are famous for being kind of kicky, and we have a tendency to see things when they're not there, in terms of, you know, the master doesn't like us, or it's this problem, or, you know, everybody's just human beings trying as best they can. And in that, we sometimes ask good questions. Sometimes we ask questions that are a bit off. But I think it's important that we ask questions, because without doing that, it's sometimes hard to receive teaching. Because in the asking of questions, there is the willingness to try to communicate and let the master know where you're coming from. And so Taiso Eka does that throughout this discourse, and Bodhidharma responds. And as I say, I think it's a really important thing to be able to ask a question. It kind of puts us out there. You know, I know for myself sometimes I want to ask the question that is an answer, so everyone will know in my question how much I know. Well, it's actually better just to ask the question. And sometimes we do know, or sometimes we just earnestly have a question. But the willingness to put ourselves out there, let our training be seen, is very important. Because that, being as the master, in the master-disciple relationship, the teacher-student relationship in Buddhism, is not someone who gets in there and fiddles with a person. Yes, they try to draw out the best in a person, but it's through their communication that the master is able to see where it is that the disciple could use help, or where it is that they're understanding. So don't be afraid to ask a question. That's the moral. Right. I'm just going to take one of these questions, because I think you could do a lecture or a number of lectures on any one of these. So Taiso Eka asks, According to what the scriptures say, the three pure precepts are our vow to cut off all evil, our vow to cultivate all good, and our vow to ferry all sentient beings to the other shore. Which is fine. That's true. But then he goes on, but you now say, control the three poisonous impulses. How can this not be a deviation from or perversion of the meaning of the scriptures? So he kind of goes off on a tangent in his question. I don't see how he got from his first statement to his second, but I know with my mind I a lot of times have a first statement and then get way off in something totally strange. So it's the working of the mind. And Bodhidharma replies. He says, the scriptures which the Buddha gave voice to are true speech and certain to be without error. When bodhisattvas in the past rigorously cultivated religious training in order to deal with the three poisons, they made three vows for keeping to the three pure precepts. Now, I really like the term rigorously cultivated religious training, because you have to do that. And by that I don't mean you have to get a sweat up, but it's by rigorously, it's something you have to do day and night, and you have to do with your whole being in your whole life, because there is no aspect of that in which there is not Buddha nature, nor is there meditation, no aspect of that in which there is not meditation. And as we train more and more, we see that we can't say, well, this is, you know, this is meditation, and then there's the playtime over here. Well, if you can have your playtime within meditation if it's meditative play. But you can't chop things up. And you do have to rigorously cultivate religious training. So it's both rigorous and you have to cultivate it. We all lack for nothing. We have the Buddha nature, and yet we need something. We need to allow that Buddha nature to be seen. And yes, a good majority of the time, the answer is in getting ourselves out of the way. But that's still an action. That's still a cultivation that we have to cultivate. Okay, they made three vows for keeping to the three pure precepts. And I think you all know what the three poisons are: greed, anger, and delusion. I've also heard delusion be called foolishness. That greed, anger, or delusion, or greed, anger, or foolishness. In dealing with the poison of greed, they vowed to cut themselves off from all evil by always cultivating the precepts. So the first precept is cease from evil. And if we really want to deal with greed, we have to cease from evil. We have to really get down in there and find the roots of the greed, the attachment that pulls us astray, and do something about it. And when we can do that, when we can work on the poison of greed, and they're called poisons because they sully our immaculacy, they sour our immaculacy, or even worse, if we indulge them and do not do something about them, and continue to go in this pattern, we find ourselves in a very difficult place. But the wonderful thing is that even in that difficult place, there is still the Buddha nature. And we can turn it around. But you always have to cultivate the precepts. That's something that we lack for nothing, but we need something. And what we need to do is we need to cultivate the precepts. We need to primarily, we need to keep them in our body, speech, and mind. And in areas where we have difficulties, real difficulties, we have to find ways to get out of that. Get out of that mindset, to get out of that body set, to get out of that speech set. I know one of the things that has helped me recently, the antidote for jealousy in Buddhism is appreciative joy. So, jealousy arises, and it does for most human beings. Basically, because we are not content in ourselves for some reason. We think that someone else has something that we don't have, when in fact, we have everything already. But that's the way human beings tick sometimes. We're jealous. And when that jealousy arises, as it does, we can indulge it, or we can let it go. And if we have a hard time letting it go, it is very helpful to aid in the process of letting go, to cultivate appreciative joy. So we can appreciate what other people have, and we can appreciate what we have. Right? And we can be happy for other people. And really, it's actually as simple as that. When we find ourselves jealous, we don't have to go with that thought. We can turn it to something else. We can turn the wheel in the positive way and appreciate what they have and appreciate what we have. I have this motto for now that I put on my door in the room in which I live. And it says appreciative joy, and under it says get a life. Because that's partly what we're doing when we're jealous. We're not getting a life. And by that, I don't mean all the hell with other people. I'll just do what I want. We got to get on with it. You know? We have everything we need right there. And we just have to get on with it. In dealing with the poison of anger, they vowed to cultivate all that is good, and thus they cultivated meditation. And meditation is extremely good for anger, as it is for many, many things, myriad things. But if in our anger we can just be still a moment, a few moments, a little while more, the anger will pass. Okay, so it arises. And the problem is not in the arising. It's in what we do with it. And if anger arises, if we can be still and meditate, and we don't have to push away the anger, okay? We just be still with it. And anger is one of those things that can be painful. To be still with it, you actually feel the pain in your body. And the more deep-rooted it is, the more you're probably going to feel that. I mean, it's exhausting. But if you can be still with it, you can see that it passes. And it only has the substance we give it. Okay? There's some karmic reason why we are angry. It's possible, initially, we did something for a good intention. But somewhere along the way, it went awry. And yet we still had that good intention. But anger is not one of those things that has to take us over. And there's the story, I think it's in Zen's Flesh, Zen Bones, about the disciple who comes to the master and just is really distraught and says, you know, I'm just angry all the time, I'm an angry person. And the Zen master says, well, show me your anger right now. And the person couldn't. So, I mean, obviously it isn't there all the time, but when you're in the midst of anger, it's pretty intense in times, and it seems like it is there always. But if you can be still with it, if you can meditate, if you can cultivate the heart that wants to meditate when there is anger, which is being still, neither holding on nor pushing it away, you can find a release from that. And it may be that also, and it most likely is, that you, as part of that, have to find out what the cause of that is, and ultimately what the root cause of that is. But always you will have to sit still with it. And if it is your part of your koan in life, part of the religious problem that arises in you, it may be there for the rest of your life in some form. But you can get a hold on it. When Reverend Dion was here talking to us, I think she said it was Great Master Kazon who had a terrible temper. Mm-hmm. Just terrible temper. And he repented for that his whole life. And he did good works to do something about that. And so what he did is he did not get stuck with himself as an angry person. He did good for other people. He didn't get mired in that. Sometimes we do, with anger, just get mired in it, and we just go back from blaming ourselves and blaming other people, and we just bounce, boom, 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 and we really don't do anything about it. So, but if you can meditate with it, if you can be still and neither hold on nor push away, you'll see that it goes, and you will begin to see what it is that causes it. In dealing with the poison of delusion, they vowed to ferry all sentient beings to the other shore, and thus always cultivated benevolent discernment. You have to excuse me, my eyes they're going back and forth on my focus, and I'm reading sometimes with my regular glasses, sometimes with my bifocals, and so having problems with blurring here. So I hope I'm somewhat lucid. No, that's okay. I don't think that's a problem. Okay, so they vowed to ferry all sentient beings to the other shore and thus always cultivated benevolent discernment. With delusion, we are really wrapped up with ourselves. Okay? We're really deluded in that we think that there is a self. It's extreme delusion. There's something that we're attaching so extremely to that it causes great difficulty. And as a way to deal this, we vow to ferry all sentient beings to the other shore. In other words, we get out of ourselves. It isn't that we go around saving other beings, but we through our meditation and that which arises naturally out of meditation, the good work, the doing good for others, which is the third of the three great precepts, we are able to see ways that we can cultivate benevolent discernment so we can do good things for self and other. And we can. And it is usually the best way that arises naturally. It comes from meditation. And the doing good for others, doing good for ourselves, is by and large not a big deal. Okay? It's those things that arise naturally every day. I can remember years ago being on a trip to the Bay Area to pick up some kitchen supplies. We had just built the new kitchen, and we needed to get shelving and various things. So I went down there and had a real time crunch to get the stuff within. And I was tired from the building of the kitchen and the moving in. And I was in an alleyway back behind a restaurant supply place. And there was a dumpster and there was a piece of garbage of some sort, maybe a I don't know, some paper or something on the ground there. So I saw it there, and I kind of made this judgment in my mind. I said, how terrible that is. I'll be good, and I'll pick it up, and I'll put it in the dumpster. Well, I did that, and I came up, and there was a metal rod in the dumpster, and I whacked my head really bad. This was not karma of my thought. I don't think. And yet, it was a good teaching in that, I was so involved in what I was doing, thinking I was doing good, I wasn't paying attention. Mm-hmm. And really, to do good properly, to have benevolent discernment, you have to pay attention in what you're doing. And you have to see what it is that you do causes. I think it's very good and generous that people want to do good in the world. But sometimes we do that in a way that we're not really looking. Okay? I mean, yes, we cannot see totally into the future. And yes, we can't just sit there or stand there and not act because we're so afraid of the consequences. But we do have to have discernment there, wise discernment, benevolent discernment, and do things for the right reason. And the wonderful thing about meditation is it really helps us in this area. Because we can neither hold on or push away, and because we are not attached to something. Okay? So sometimes what will happen with people is they'll be very some kind of cause-oriented, and it'll just get them into tunnel vision in terms of the way they see right and wrong, and good and evil. And it's not that simple. Reverend Dion, when she was here, talked about she's spending much time in Japan in the 70s and early 80s. And I think you probably, a lot of you are familiar with the book now, Zen at War, is that what it's called? And it talks about, at least from this person's perspective and study, what went on there from the turn of the century on, and how this kind of mindset that this person sees with some of the Buddhist churches came about. What Reverend Dion said is, without excusing whatever people did, it is important that we think about the culture in which they lived in and the times in which they lived in. And things are not always so simple. And that, again, that's not an excuse. Doesn't make anything right. But when we look through things with that filter, in an odd way, maybe we see it more clearly. Because we can sometimes, as I say, be so, for a good reason, attached to a cause or a way of looking at things, that we form an attachment. And consequently, we do get a bit of tunnel vision. And it's a wide world, a lot of people, a lot of things going on. And it's a world of samsara, not a very perfect world. Because they kept to the three types of pure teachings, precepts, meditation, and benevolent discernment, they were able to go beyond the evil deeds of the three poisons and thereby realize Buddhahood. So you've got the three types of pure teaching: precepts, meditation, and benevolent discernment. And I think here, too, when we talk of benevolent discernment, we're talking about the things that we do, the meditation in action. Okay, so you've got the precepts, which we should study so they become our blood and bones. We've got the meditation, which the precepts actually flow out of quite naturally. And also we've got benevolent discernment, that's meditation in action, which comes out of that stillness and that study of the precepts, and allows us to live as responsible human beings. And we're going to make mistakes. You know, we're just going to... That's the way it is. But if we study the precepts and we meditate, and we do this with... What's the term here? Rigorous, cultivated religious training. If we do it in that way, that is, if we do it regularly and with consistency, we're going to make a lot less mistakes. And the magnitude of them will probably be smaller. Okay, they were able to go beyond the evil deeds of the three poisons and thereby realize Buddhahood. And we can do this. Is it right, Jermaine? Come on, you should probably use a chair. We can... using this here. We can go beyond the evil deeds. We can go beyond greed, hate, and delusion. And by going on beyond them, it doesn't mean that they will not arise, because they will arise as long as we're human beings. But we will be able to be still with them, and we'll be able to neither hold on or push them away, and we'll be able to not act from them, because they only have substance and form that we give them.
Is that what you're saying?
Pardon me?
We only have substance.
The substance and form that we give them.
Yeah, thanks.
Because it is through our controlling of the three poisons that all evil dissolves and evaporates, we call this cutting ourselves free. And really, these are the things, the three poisons, that bind us. When we are enmeshed in them, it is very hard to show our Buddha nature. But when we can work on them through the precepts, through meditation, through benevolent discernment, we are able to cut these chains that bind us. That's the cutting ourselves free. That's the real freedom. But the freedom is in the precepts, the meditation, and the benevolent discernment. It is not from them. It's very much in them. And I think freedom is a very misunderstood word. We have great freedom in every moment within all the myriad conditions that we find ourselves in our everyday lives. We have freedom. Even when things seem oppressive, we have freedom. We can meditate. Now, freedom doesn't necessarily mean that all is wonderful and that the conditions dissolve. They may not, but we still have freedom. I correspond with prisoners, And one of the things that they often say is how hard it is in prison, how noisy it is, how crowded, how there's a lot of screaming from when you get up in the morning to when you go to bed at night. There is. Okay? No one's going to say that there isn't. But those are not reasons why one cannot train. They're just simply the conditions that those people live in. Not simply because they are hard, but simply in the sense that they are conditions and that they can meditate within those conditions. Reverend Dionne told the story when she was here about a prison in Pennsylvania that had a lockdown for, I don't know, 80 or 90 days. And so she was not able to get in there to see the meditation group. And when she finally did, after she came in and she said to the men in the meditation group, you know, how's it going? They said, well, we had a great session for those 90 days. I'm sure it was not easy, but, you know, that they could see it that way, as opposed to pure hell breaking loose, or the strictness of the prison authorities under those conditions. That's wonderful. And that's what meditation can do. But in those conditions, they can meditate. You know, we can make excuses, and we can wait for when the conditions are perfect. We can make endless excuses. And most likely, the conditions will never be perfect. There's the story of the man before World War II who was fed up with the world, so he bought an island somewhere in the South Pacific and went to live on it. This was his paradise. Well, it turns out it was one of the major sites for the battles of World War II. You know, here's paradise. And still, after the war, I bet it was a beautiful island. By skillfully keeping to the three precepts, good becomes all. This is called the cultivation of training for Buddhahood. When we can cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others, good does become all. Okay. And it is not as though, well, it is as though we realize that we can train within the myriad conditions that life presents us. We can cease from evil, we can do only good, and we can do good for others. And it is the cultivation of training of Buddhahood. Because we have to keep cultivating. We have to keep doing something. We have not made it. And we need to keep keeping the precepts. We need to keep ceasing from evil. We need to keep doing only good. We need to keep doing good for others. This is the Bodhisattva way. By training and skillfully cutting ourselves free, we perfect all our myriad practices and actions. And that's what we have to do. We have to, in everything we do, find the mind of meditation. Because it is there. For some reason we don't see it, but it is there. And we have to do the things that we do not like to do if they need doing. And I think for all of us, there's things that we do not like to do, but we know they need doing. And the more that we can do those with the mind that neither holds on or pushes away, it's most likely the easier it will be to do those things we need to do. And in time, we will convert them to not such a big deal. It's amazing how in the mind we get all kind of worked up about all the things that we need to do, all the things that are going to be coming at us that day, all the problems, all the things that can go wrong. And then when we just get in there and do them, it's like, well, what's the big deal here? You know? Yes, some things are hard than others. Sometimes you're dealing with a company and you just get sent from one person to the other, to the other, to the other. That's the way it is. And if we can just be still within it, we don't have to like it. Training within the conditions isn't saying, oh, how wonderful everything is. It may not be wonderful. It may be not so great. But if that's what there is, we can train within that. Because self and others have benefit and all sentient beings everywhere are aided, it is called ferrying others to the other shore. So the ferrying of others to the other shore is also ferrying ourselves. Okay. And it's not, by and large, it's not the grand gesture or the dramatic action. It's the everyday just being there and doing what needs doing. And sometimes that's not so clear, but we try our best. And should we make a mistake? Should you find, well, there's probably a better way to do that, or I shouldn't have done that? We realize that we take the consequences, and we make a mental note of that, so hopefully we don't do that again, and we get on with things. Therefore, understand that the precepts and practices which you cultivate are not something existing apart from your mind. They're right there. They're right there with us. It isn't like there's these things out there. It's right here. Right here, and we can all do it. We can all cultivate it. We can all practice it. If you yourself are immaculate, then all sentient beings are immaculate through and through. We have to realize our own immaculacy, which is really the mind that neither holds on nor pushes away and just can be still. But we have to realize that. We can't go around feeling that we can't do that, nor feeling that we're the only ones who can do it. Everyone can do that. Everyone can enjoy the immaculacy. All sentient beings are immaculate, through and through. That is why the scripture says, when the mind is tainted, then sentient beings are tainted. When the mind is pure, then sentient beings are true, or excuse me, are pure. So when the mind is tainted, then sentient beings are tainted. And if we look at things from a mind, from a heart that is tainted, everything seems tainted. And tainted can be just something missing. Okay? Or we're judgmental in the way that we view it. When the mind is pure, when it can neither hold on or push away, when it can be still, then we see the purity of all sentient beings. That doesn't mean that the world is perfect. But it means that it is pure and that all sentient beings are perfect. All sentient beings are just training, okay, doing their best. And when we can let go of the judgment of them, and by that I don't mean that if somebody's off the wall, up the spout, that we just dismiss that. No. But we still see that they have the Buddha nature and we don't have to join them. And we don't have to agree with them. We can say, no, that's not the way to go. But we still see their Buddha nature. We still see their purity. The scripture also says, if you wish to be able to purify the Buddha lands, you must purify that mind of yours. So we really have to do the training right here, each one of us. When we can do that, this great purity opens up in all things. But it's the doing something about ourselves that allows us to see that. To that extent that your mind is pure, so the Buddha lands are pure. If you are able to control the three types of poisonous impulses, the three pure precepts will be naturally perfected.